given us the first AI-integrated, fully sentient Nigga bot with 6 million megahertz per Negro second processing speeds, pregnant women detection software, hyper-strengthened carbon fiber neck upgrades, counterfeit money printer with direct auto buys and deployed AI coin on Solana, perfected three-point jump shot integration with a NeuroFlex data hustle chip.
Are you fucking crazy? You're gonna make him too powerful.
Galaxy gas plasma burners, gang sign translating software, Fent reactor mining cryptocurrency while you sleep. He is the only AI Nigga bot capable of driving a Dodge Hellcat while shooting full auto Glocks. This cyborg Nigga is not to be fucked with.
Welcome to the stream. We're back with another show. It is the 17th of January, 2025. And some Floyd AI Kena. I thought that was kind of funny. You know, one thing that I have noticed, black people don't like talking about, and I don't know too many black people, but I've noticed this from online. Black people do not like talking about George Floyd. We memed George Floyd too hard to the point that, like, it's become our thing. We keep bringing it up. We have all these, like, ridiculously, like, elaborate derivative memes. And blacks don't want to talk about George Floyd. In fact, since, you know, in the years leading up to the George Floyd incident, the fentanyl overdose, you know, there was all of these different stories coming out of America of a black person dying at the hands of the police. Black Lives Matter was always in the news. There were, you know, they were really relevant for like many, many years. It was constantly being discussed. They were constantly angry about some new victim in one situation or another. But the last few years, I ain't heard anything about this stuff. I'm sure they're still operating. I'm sure lefties are still talking about it. But the prevailing society doesn't give a shit anymore. We've become totally desensitized to the subject. And if they did try to have another George Floyd, everyone would just meme the fuck out of it. Like it would be ridiculed into oblivion. It wouldn't be taken seriously. We'd have a field day with it online. And I just think that's interesting. It's almost like we've created this like memetic defense mechanism, like as the Aryan race against this bullshit at this point. And so it's like dead as a meme, as a possibility. Interesting if they try to revive it again anytime soon, but it feels dead as a meme. And I think that's kind of funny as well. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, when was the last time you heard about it? Like, since George Floyd, there hasn't been really any more George Floyds. It was like fucking 4 years
ago. I got to be honest. I didn't really know what you were talking about then. I found that video funny. Just so everyone knows, I hadn't seen that video. I didn't know Joel was going to play it. But it was pretty amusing. Where did you find that?
I just saw it on Twitter.
Well, it's a good choice to open up the stream. I liked it. Good,
I know you're very parochial, Blair, but you know who George Floyd was, right? Like, obviously.
He was the black guy that got killed by the cops in America, right?
Well, he didn't get killed by the cops. The cop leant on him and then he died of a fentanyl overdose. Then they said that he killed him. But yeah.
Right. Everyone, didn't he get buried in like a gold coffin or something?
Or yeah.
Was that just a rumor?
Probably. Yeah.
I know that he was like a symbol. He was like a symbol of Black Lives Matter and all the rioting that ensued as a result of his tragic passing. But I didn't really follow it too closely. I just remember, didn't that kid that shot those people and he ended up getting off for it? What was his name again?
Kyle Rittenhouse.
Did that emerge out of the George Floyd riots? Was George Floyd before Rittenhouse? Right. So something good came of it then.
2020.
That was a really interesting case to follow.
Yeah, but that was nearly 5 years ago. And I remember going into work when it first blew up because I remember this was during COVID. I remember going into work because I was an essential worker. So I still had to go to work. I went into work.
You're still essential. You're an essential nationalist worker now.
Yeah. But I went into work on the day and my buddy of mine he's a white dude. He's like a white hipster dude, but he liked hip hop. Like he was like a SoundCloud rapper. He was all right. I mean, I don't like hip hop as much as he does, but he was kind of cool, whatever. We used to hang out and I get in there and he's like, oh man, like black people are really mad about this George Floyd thing. check this out. And he was showing me the videos and like it ended up like blowing up. That was before it even blew up. But I guess he had the finger on the pulse of like the black social media because he's into hip hop or whatever. It's kind of crazy that that is now like impossible. Like that kind of like outrage cycle to like then like escalate. Obviously it was juiced. Obviously specifically the riots that happened in 2020.
What do you think is impossible? You think it's impossible for a situation like George Floyd to inflame a section of the population again? You don't think that'll happen again?
Well, it could inflame a section of the population, but it couldn't like grip, it grips society to the point where like normies were like on the side of the left, you know, on that, in that situation. And it was almost like, oh, it's justified that blacks are just going to burn down all these cities. And then it pissed everyone off. And then you got the reaction and people ended up turning against it. But the point was there was this like massive rage and all the politicians had to come out, and even international politicians that weren't even from America, or everyone had to weigh in on it and be like, oh, this is horrible. It was such a big deal at the time. It was, I can't even like it was like the biggest story in the world at the time for like weeks. And it was just like this outrage cycle. I can't imagine an outrage cycle perpetuating itself to that extent without the right wing jamming it with ridicule, counter narratives and so on, and like disrupting it and blowing it up before it got to that stage.
Do you think it's possible to produce our own? What about producing our own similar outrage cycle as you describe it? Do you think we could possibly do that if the situation arose?
We don't really have like a victim complex.
We don't, but should we? Maybe we should develop more of a victim complex, because we are, you know, on an international scale, we're the victim race of all this multiculturalism and shit. So maybe we need to adopt more of that sort of victim mentality.
Part of the George Floyd thing as well, though, is like Black Lives Matter, we're getting a lot of funding. There's institutional support. And part of what that riot was, in my opinion, was it was kind of a shit test of, because that was during Trump's first term, and it was kind of like the regime was shit testing him, shit testing his ability to declare martial law, because it was almost like they were going to see like which way the, you know, the institutions would go under pressure, because they were preparing for obviously rigging the election later that year. So I think there was a little bit of that going on, which is why it got so amplified. But even despite that, there were so many of these stories of like black victimhood that were, you know, massive in America, like iteratively year after year after year for years, going back to like when Obama was president. I remember it kind of starting. So it's just interesting that it's completely died off. Now, part of it is probably also the fact that Black Lives Matter is pro-Palestine because they're all like communists. And so the Jewish backers, you know, now that Israel's under threat, they, you know, maybe rug pulled them a little bit as well. So there are these kind of like institutional dynamics going on behind all of this. But I do think that the culture has shifted. And my point is on that, on the George Floyd thing, I remember like there were George Floyd memes that were funny that we started producing organically in the aftermath and like a year later after the riots. And then they started to get old. By like 2022, it was like, okay, like we've done the George Floyd thing to death.
That's pretty much true of all meme culture, though. Meme, you know, relevant sort of topics that get morphed into memes, they don't last very long. They're not cool or funny for very long. Politics moves quickly.
They got a cycle, and like, yeah, everything has a cycle. You know, it's every creative form. It's like in music. Like a genre gets big, there's a whole bunch of bands or acts or producers or whatever that, you know, a part of a vibe over a few years, and then it gets old and the fashion shifts, and that's just normal. That's just how culture works. But it kind of died off. But then there's been this second wave, mostly through TikTok, fueled by Zoomers who might not even fucking remember the George Floyd riots, or barely do because they were kids. And the George Floyd meme has transformed into George Droid, and now he's like an android AI, and it's become this like totally absurd derivative version of itself, like we just witnessed. And you know, it's funny. It's pretty funny. But anyway, we yapped about a meme for a while. If you're watching on X, juice the stream. You know, like, retweet, spread it around. We've been getting good views on X pretty consistently of late, and it's the most popular platform for people to watch the show. So juice it around. You know, spread the show. But Yeah, the main thing that I want to
there's an observable swing back in our direction, isn't there, Joel? Politically, I mean. I think there's certain elitists trying to make it a controlled swing back to the right, you might say. But we're back on the map. We're able to post. We're able to broadcast our messages out there in the public. And we haven't really had a situation like this since around 2016, before the big censorship campaign began. And then especially after Christchurch in New Zealand, basically everyone in Australia got nuked. I was among the first. But we're back. It looks like we're back. And so we can really start hammering that message again and contribute to that broad awakening.
Yeah, like Twitter is not perfect when it comes to censorship. People do get banned that are on our side, but it's definitely not as bad as it was. Obviously, it's great to have Rumble as an option as well to stream on. So, yeah, I mean...
It's a bit of an understatement to say it's not as bad as it was. I mean, some of the stuff I see in my newsfeed, you would never get away with that sort of stuff in the old Twitter.
Yeah.
So,
there's more propaganda now going viral every day. You know, AI...
It almost looks like 4chan. Like, Twitter feed, my Twitter newsfeed is like 4chan almost.
Yeah. No, exactly. And the great thing is when you see like a left winger that's like, this website is just like covered in Nazi propaganda now. What the hell? What's happened? And it's like, that's how you know that it's really saturating the platform.
But it's not even Nazi propaganda It's not even that as much as it is just people observing reality and making fun of how absurd the system we live under is. You got to remember that too. What the left categorizes Nazi propaganda isn't actually a lot of the time propaganda. It's just someone making observations of the absurdity of the regime. So yeah. There's a lot of normal people out there with a lot of normal takes observing society, and a lot of the so-called, you know, Nazi propaganda is just that.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, the word propaganda just means it's just like ideas being propagated.
It means to spread about. You might say that to be a conscientious propagandist means to be conscious of what you're doing. You're deliberately oversimplifying a message in order to deliver a certain, social political narrative. But not everybody's doing that. And what gets classified as propaganda or hate speech, which, you know, Nazi propaganda and hate speech are kind of the same thing to the leftists. It's not always actually propaganda, is what I'm saying. A lot of the time, it's just like normal people with normal perspectives.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's maybe abnormal by the contrived social expectations of the current year to have our views, but our views are normal historically. It's a very recent development that everything racist or homophobic or transphobic or sexist or whatever is like beyond the pale. Like, these are just totally made up rules of discourse that, you know, it's like the last 60 years, these things were kind of mainstreamed, and nothing like them ever existed until that point in history. So everyone else is the kind of abnormal. We live in an abnormal society. We're normal actually in just being like, hey, wait a second. Like, what, like, maybe that wasn't a great idea. Maybe all of these ideas that were conjured up by Jews and other subversive elements, communists and so on, to destroy our society, maybe we shouldn't adopt that value system. Maybe that value system is actually destroying the very fabric of our country and all of our nations actually across the West, and basically stealing the birthright of our children. So how about we don't adopt those ideas? But
it was never supposed to help you, my friends. Multiculturalism, it was never about living in harmony. It was never about producing some noble society of equality. It was just about destroying us. It was destructive from the beginning. Like, it was, you know, basically a lot of people just got tricked into supporting a destructive regime, a subversive effort to annihilate our nationality. And that's the whole point. So from that perspective, multiculturalism is not failing. It's wholly successful. So I'm not one of those people who say, oh, multiculturalism is not working. It actually is working, because it's only meant to displace and eventually ethnically replace white people down here in Australia. And that's exactly what it's doing. So it's actually a successful regime from that point of view.
Yeah, like, the purpose of a system is what it does.
The purpose of a system is what it does or what it's doing, not what they say it does. It's what it actually is doing physically and tangibly, right?
Yeah, of course. It's about It's about politically disempowering whites, and the ultimate way to be politically disempowered is to be killed. But it's about putting us in a position where they can kill us off, where we're the minority and we have no power.
The final victory, the only final victory in politics is when your race dies. So long as your race survives, you can live to fight another day, so to speak, and add another generation down the line. But once your race is destroyed, you can never come back from that. So that is the final defeat. It's the final victory that our deadliest enemy is trying to accomplish.
Yeah, this is something that I've talked about before, about how globalism, the project of human rights, quote-unquote, how this is actually the most genocidal idea ever conceived. Because in the past, prior to the Second World War, if you went to war with another group of people, maybe they would end up, you would be defeated and they'd take some of your land. Like, so in like World War One, Germany is fighting, you know, Britain and France, and then Germany loses. And so Britain and France and the other allies, you know, America, we were there, we're sitting around and saying, well, you lost, so we get, you know, Treaty of Versailles, we get something. So then a bit of Germany that is given to France, a bit of Germany is given to, like, a little bit of section of territory is given to Italy, some is carved out from Germany and given to Poland, and that was like how you lose. But Germany still existed, it still lived to fight another day. What happened this time is we get control of the media, we get control of the academia, we get control of, like, every facet of your society. We make it illegal for you to develop nationalism ever again, to develop any ideas of self-preservation. And then we inculcate you with, like, a suicidal political ideology that slowly destroys you forever. And that's, this kind of thing has never really been done before. We're in a whole new paradigm. And then the thing that's most sick about it as well is that we supposedly won the war, but we also get hit with the same disease. But anyway, we've covered that idea many, many times. I wanted to talk about this. And I know, Blair, you are on Twitter. You don't spec into the discourse and the polemics going on like right
now. I might start, but currently I don't. I'm currently a little bit busy. And I'm also kind of growing up. I'm getting old. I'm 35 now. So it feels like I don't have the... Does anyone else experience this? It's like you get to 35 and it feels like you just have no time. When you're young, it's like time stretches out and you feel like you can do more in a day. But now I just feel like after my day is filled with tasks and clients and work, it's like, shit, where did all that time go, man? But I do intend to get a bit more involved in the discourse. That's the point.
Yeah, well, a lot of this discourse was spinning out of America. But, like, you know, a lot of the Australian conservatives are kind of linked in with the American conservative commentators. And so the conversation bled into like Australian Twitter as well. And that's true even for us. Like, we're connected to the white nationalists. The conservatives are connected to the American conservatives. The, you know, the Australian lefties are connected to the American lefties. So whenever, like, America has an argument, basically we get sucked in if you're engaged in the online right. And there was a kind of like legacy. So obviously between Christmas and New Year's, there was a really big argument that took place over Indian immigration, H-1B visas in America. You know, Elon Musk is at war with basically, you know, white nationalist Twitter. And that was interesting to observe. And I can see echoes of it kind of popping up in the past week, where basically a bunch of American conservative commentators were more or less telling, you know, young whites who were complaining about how, well, you know, I went to university, I studied, I got a degree, but it's really difficult to find a job because of DEI and all the, you know, immigrants that they're bringing in to fill all these roles. And then even when I find a job, it doesn't really pay that much. And, you know, it's really expensive to buy a house in any major city now because of mass immigration. And I'm forced to go and, like, buy a shitty house in, like, a neighborhood, a non-white neighborhood that I don't want to live in, or rent in the white neighborhood of a city. And, like, basically it's impossible then to save money and put into, like, buying a house. Like, this is bullshit. Like, it's impossible for me to ascend to the middle class, even though I did everything right. Everyone said, if you go to university, get your degree, get qualified in, like, STEM or some, like, you know, field where you can make it, quote unquote. you're still are battling, and you shouldn't be battling. That wasn't the deal. Like back in the 80s, if you did this, you would just enter the middle class. And then a whole bunch of conservatives were firing back with like ridiculous talking points, saying like, well, you know, when I was young, I had to work hard and to get to the position that I'm in now. And, you know, hey, look, it's not so bad out there. Just go live in a shittier city. Just go live in a shittier suburb. Or like if you can't find a job in, you know, software development because they've given all the jobs to H-1B Indians, well, go get a job at a fast food restaurant or go get a job as a delivery driver. That you can get pretty good money doing that. And they're just ridiculous talking points like this. And just basically saying like, stop complaining. Zoomers have such a bad attitude. They feel they're so entitled. Young people don't want to work hard anymore. They don't want to struggle, all of this kind of thing. And just like blaming young whites when it's just objectively the case that there's been inflation. The cost of living is significantly higher than it has been in the post-war era. The price of housing as a ratio to wages is significantly higher. Wages have been growing slower than like the cost of living or house prices for decades upon decades upon decades. How is this going to add up? Like people that were growing up in the 80s, where you could go and buy a house and pay off a mortgage in like a decade if you had like a decent job. I mean, that's a pipe dream now. Like in Sydney, to buy a shitty house in the average suburb, like an average house in Sydney, to get a mortgage, they estimate that you need to basically be earning almost $300,000 a year. Who the fuck's earning $300,000 a year? Almost nobody. Like even people that have gone to university, they're working, they're a doctor, they're a software developer. Maybe they're earning $200,000 a year. Maybe they're a corporate executive. Almost no one is earning $300,000 a year. Maybe if you have like the husband and wife that are both professionals, they can afford that. But they're moving into some shitty suburbs surrounded by Chinese people. And they're commuting an hour a day, an hour back to work in some office where they've got like an HR department run by like hardcore leftists that systematically, discriminate against white men and whites in general in these fields. And the reason why they're bringing immigrants in, or why like, you know, the industrial lobbies and corporate lobbies want immigrants brought in, is because they know that it suppresses wages. It's done intentionally. And the studies have been done. This is just an objective fact. And it just makes sense on the basis of supply and demand. If you bring in more people to compete for the same jobs, it keeps wages low. Because now when you put out you need to fill a role, if you've got 10 applicants to choose from, and you go, well, you know, they're obviously all looking for a job, and you offer, you know, the best candidate the job or the second best candidate the job. If they knock it back, one of them will take it. Whereas if you are advertising for a role and only two or three guys are coming in to get interviewed that are qualified, but they're also doing interviews at two or three other places, then you're actually having to compete on wages, and maybe you're going to have to pay, instead of 150 grand, you're going to have to pay 180 grand or something to try and like secure them. So it puts upward pressure on wages when there's, you know, when there's less supply of labor, the value goes up. And it's the same when you're looking for a rental. Like if you're going to rent a house, or if you're trying to rent your house out and you do an open home and only like three people come to the open home and like only two of them apply to rent it, or one of them applies to rent it or something, then, you know, or if no one applies, actually, and you're putting it at $500 a week and you do an open home or two, no one makes an application. Well, maybe you knock it down to $450 or something to try and get someone to rent it out. Otherwise you're just losing money that you could be making. But if you do an open home and like 40 Pajits show up and then they all apply straight away, well, and then that keeps happening. The real estate agent starts noticing that, and they go, well, instead of putting it up for 500 a week, you know, there's a lot of demand out there. Why don't we try 520? Why don't we try 550? Or people go in and they see, look at how many other people are in this open home. It's really hard to get a place these days. And then they go and like bid up. They'll go in and say, oh, I'll pay 6 months in advance, or I'll pay fucking, 520 a week, even though it's listed at 500. Just here's cash right now. Let's do it. And so competition, that's what it produces. So it's like when they say, oh, you don't want to compete with immigrants, it's just because you're not, confident in your own abilities. That's just fucking gaslighting. even if you win the competition, if you're competing for a house or you're competing for a job, even if you win the competition, winning the competition means you're getting paid less as a wage and you're paying more on rent. And so therefore you're fucking worse off. It's a race to the fucking bottom competing with these third world immigrants. So even winning the competition, you still lose. That's the fucking point. Like a lot of these guys who are complaining, they aren't bums who don't want to work or they aren't bums who didn't get educated. A lot of the young guys that were complaining on Twitter that precipitated this argument have degrees. And they're like, I got a degree and I can't find work. Like this is bullshit. Or I've found work, but it's not paying enough and I can't like buy a house and get going with my life. Like I've been I did everything the way that you told me I was supposed to and I'm still fucked over. And the conservative response should be, yeah, the system's broken, the country's broken, it's been rigged against young whites. We need to like figure out a whole set of policies that'll make it so that young white men who work hard get rewarded and can build a life and can join the middle class. Like back in the 80s, when I was growing up, because a lot of these guys are like Gen Xers, they should be thinking, well, pretty much everyone who did do it the right way ultimately succeeded. They were all able to get on the property ladder. They were all able to join the middle class. Basically, any qualified professional who just like showed up and wasn't a dickhead in mismanaging their money joined the middle class in those days in Australia or America. Now, almost no one is able to attain a middle class existence. Everyone's fucking up to their eyeballs in debt. Young people are barely able to buy a fucking house. Otherwise, they're pissing all their money up the wall on rent. Like, this is not how a society is supposed to be. Like, this is not how, this is not the dream, you know, back, like, this is not what was promised. The social contract has been ripped up. And this is the fundamental problem with conservatives. Conservatives will take a political problem, which is mass immigration, DEI, like institutional discrimination against white people, which is what DEI is, et cetera, inflation, things like that. And they'll go, oh, I'm going to blame all of this on you as an individual and your inability to work hard. The whole point of politics is trying to solve problems at the social level, at the political level. It's not like a self-help seminar. Like when you tune into Matt Walsh from the Daily Wire or Christopher Rufo or one of these fucking people and hear what they have to say, these people are supposed to be political activists. They're supposed to be pushing for what the government should be doing. They aren't there to tell you how to live your life. If you're a normal upstanding white man, you don't need someone to tell you how to live your life. You're not a retard. You know how to live your own life. You don't need to be told that. What you need to be told is, how are we going to fix the country? That's the whole point of engaging in political discourse or consuming political content, not to be like lectured and patronized to. And this is why conservatives always fucking lose, because they have this fucking bootstrap mentality, this pick yourself up by your bootstrap mentality of, oh, or just work harder, goy. Just, you know, like you have a bad attitude, goy. And it's like the left, they go and tell their followers, the reason why your life sucks is because of these people in power who we hate, or these people who we tell you to hate. And so we need to attack them politically and implement policies that reward you and punish them. And that will make your life better.
I think when Australia was more homogenous, that conservative talking point of, hey, you know, get your shit together, square your own shit away, maybe that'll make a difference in your life socially, and maybe it's not somebody else's fault. That talking point was relevant when we had a homogenous society, but we don't now, right? So things have changed. I think they need to move with the flow of the times, these so-called conservatives. And what do you think they do say stuff like this still? Is it just that they haven't really, the change in culture hasn't really hit them in the face yet? Or maybe they're so linked in to the system, like they have that Thai wife and, you know, half Asian kids, so they can never really accept that the diversity, the multiculturalism is actually as destructive as it is, because that would mean they would need to admit that they've kind of married into it, and that's difficult to do. So maybe it's just a cope when conservatives say this, when they focus on the individual merit and so-called success of the individual and kind of blame everything on individual circumstance rather than sort of changing social structure or like the changing political landscape. So yeah, it's I think it's a cope personally. Probably they either haven't sort of paid enough attention to be aware of the damage that's been done to the country and the fact we're competing with a great deal of people from outside of this country, people we shouldn't need to compete with for jobs inside our own country. So yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I think you said what you said really well, but conservatives do tend to be too rooted in that old-fashioned individualism, which no longer applies. Individualism and focusing on the individual performance merit still carries over to some degree, but it's not as relevant as it once was due to the competition we have with other races.
And that's the thing. Like, the left wing are fighting, they're playing team sports, or we're playing politics as an individual sport. And I use this metaphor all the time, but you're always going to lose. Like, if you are playing a soccer game and it's 11v11 and you have better players than the other team, but you don't have a coach, you don't have a tactic, you aren't even wearing the same uniforms, and you're not even conscious of the fact that you're on the same team, because if you acknowledge that and then try to develop a tactic about how to win the game, that would make you racist or something. Then it doesn't matter if you have better players. You're going to lose against the other team that's like well-drilled, well-organized, with a tactic, with a coach that's playing as a team. So, and that's basically like politics in a nutshell. So, and then I come along and say, hey, how about we get a coach and start playing as a team? You're a Nazi, or like, you're a racist. It's like, okay, and like, Hitler proved himself as a pretty good coach. Maybe we can't bring him back, but you know, maybe we need a coach like that again. You know, if you know anything about professional sports, the coach usually is more important than the players. The coach actually is the one that's making the decisions and putting the team together and ultimately setting the team up for success. But yeah, but they say, oh, well, you just can't compete. You just can't compete with the other team, and you're just sore losers. And it's like, you know, it's just ridiculous. But yeah,
but other races have representatives across the whole political spectrum, right? On the left, in the center, on the right, and even in the fringes in some circumstances. But regardless of where they are on that spectrum, especially one race in particular, they're always looking out for their own ethnic interests. So they'll say they represent this or that, but really they're still working for their own team, their own ethnic team. And we're probably one of the only races not doing that, which you've pointed out on a number of occasions, and it's very true. So we shouldn't be so swayed by political persuasion, especially not if it's going to turn us against our own ethnic interests. If we're going to position ourselves somewhere on the political spectrum, we need to do it for a specific or strategic purpose that's going to be advantageous to our race. That should be our motivation at all times, always. Whatever we say we are, whatever we say we're doing, even if it's a ruse, it needs to be to advance our own ethnic interests. Other races are doing that, especially our the illustrious Chosenites, the government's biggest lobbyists currently down here in Australia. So, you know, we need to be thinking along those same lines, because we can't compete with other races that are doing that unless we're doing that as well. Especially we can't compete if all the people, all the white people in politics, are actually fighting for somebody else's team rather than their own.
Yeah, exactly. But also they say, oh, you're just like the wokes, but you just want to do identity politics for whites instead of for abos or blacks or something. And yeah,
that's the future though, man. That's the future. Identity politics is the future. Identity politics kind of trumps what's the other sort of politics other than identity politics? Like, what, economics, economic discussion? What would you say, Joel? If we're not doing identity politics, what are we doing?
Yeah, like, the whole idea of having a country is identity politics. You're identifying as an Australian or a German or something, and you're saying we should have our own separate government and territory to the other humans on the earth. Like, the whole premise of a country is identity politics. Exactly. So if you, but yeah, but the point though is, like, what's wrong with wokeness? What's wrong with wokeness is that wokeness is systematically discriminating against us. It's systematically disempowering us. So if you go, hey, how about instead of systematically disempowering us, we try to systematically empower ourselves instead? How about we try and get advantages for ourselves? How about we try and get ahead and secure the best future and existence for our people, for our families? They go, you're woke. It's like, that's not, so what does woke mean then? Woke just kind of means trying to win at politics or something?
Woke to me is starting to mean conscientious. That's what it's starting to mean. It's like, woke is you're aware that you have a race, you have an identity, and that the whole world, all the politics of the world, essentially boils down to race war. It boils down to that, and that you're aware of that, and you're fighting for your own team, your own race. It seems like that's what woke is starting to mean, especially now that they're using this term woke right all over the X or Twitter.
Yeah, the term
woke right. What do you think? Would you say that's a fair summary of what woke is starting to mean?
Yeah, I mean,
Not necessarily, because if we're going to describe leftists as woke, they're certainly not fighting for their own team, but they are conscientiously fighting for foreign teams. So they're kind of doing the same thing, but in the reverse.
Yeah, well, what the word woke comes from is blacks in America, they were saying, oh, I'm woke, meaning I'm aware of systematic oppression against black people. That's what it meant to be woke, being aware of it's black racial consciousness. So then it came to mean basically left-wing politics in general, which is, you know, fighting oppressive, the so-called oppressive, you know, white patriarchy or something, and deconstructing it by allying with feminists and LGBT.
What you said before that's interesting. You said that initially woke boiled down to black ethnic consciousness. I think right now what I'm basically saying is it boils down to just ethnic consciousness generally. You're either conscious that you have a race and that you need to fight for it, or you're consciously fighting against a certain race for a certain purpose, even your own. One way or another, woke sort of just means ethnic consciousness at this stage in the way it's being used.
Yeah, by some. I mean, a lot of people just refer to woke as anti-white stuff. They're like, oh, they want to change Australia Day and get rid of the flag and, you know, do welcome to countries and, you know, have trans people in women's sports and shit like that.
If that's the case, though, then what do they mean when they say woke right? What do they mean when they say that?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. So these people are trying to expand the definition. That's what I'm kind of polemicizing. Well, if that, now you're changing what woke means from just attacking white people and white nations and white families on a political level to mean just organizing around identity politics or just organizing around some kind of notion of racial team sports or identitarian team sports. Well, then at that point, it's like, okay, they're playing this game against us. Why don't we play it against them? Like if someone comes along and we're having an argument and then they take the argument to like punching me in the face and then I punch them back and then you go, hey, you're just as bad as him. It's like, he just punched me. So now we're in a fight. So it's like, if the left is going to punch us with identity politics, why aren't we punching back with identity politics? Like I get that a lot of whites don't want to have to, you know, adopt this political lens and boil everything down to race and like fight on racial terms, but it's like, it's too late to like avoid the fight. If you wanted to avoid the fight, you should have popped up back in the 1960s and said, hey, let's not open the borders. Hey, let's keep things how they are. We like things how they are. But it wasn't done to the extent necessary to prevent this outcome from coming to fruition. And now the enemy has taken over the media. They've taken over the universities. They've taken over basically all the corporations, the bankers, everything is on their side. The enemy is inside the gates and they're bringing in millions and millions every year more of these non-whites and grouping them up and weaponizing them against us. So now we've got to fight back. We don't actually have a choice. And then they go, these idiots that use this woke right label, they call themselves classical liberals and they say, oh, you're just playing into their hands. You see, this is what they want. They want you to react like that so that it destroys liberal democracy or something. And it's like liberal democracy was destroyed the moment you let them in, because liberal democracy was originally a system that was designed for a homogenous society where you have a society of people where everyone is white, everyone is Christian, everyone shares a sense of national identity, and they have a gentlemanly political debate and opposition around, you know, certain issues. But, you know, back in the 1950s, they've done studies on this. People like both political sides respected each other. If your neighbor voted for the other political party or whatever, it didn't make you trust them any less. You still went to the same church as they did. You still helped them out as neighbors or whatever. They needed to have their mail taken in or their dog fed when they go on holiday or something. It didn't used to really like define social relationships. Now politics has become so polarizing because, you know, now they're attacking you on your identitarian basis. Like in those days, whether the left-wing one or the right-wing one, both sides were like, this is a white Christian country. These are our values. This is who we are. Now it's like, I mean, I guess they both agree on attacking us, but like one side attacks harder than the other, I guess you could say. But basically political polarization now oscillates around one side completely just going for the jugular. You don't deserve to have a country, an identity, and, you know, calling you a racist if you, you know, fart sideways. That's now basically what the left is. So it's like, well, this is no longer a gentlemanly combat. These people are literally trying to steal my country off me. Or off us. So why do we need to be gentlemanly constitutional liberal Democrats now? Now it's a fucking, it's like an existential battle for, do we get to have a country anymore or not?
Yeah, precisely. That's very well said. I don't really have anything to add to that specific segment. I think you, you did a good job explaining. In summary, you could say conservatives don't really have valid talking points, and they try to invalidate the concern that we have for the future of our country and our own ethnic existence by suggesting that anyone standing up for their ethnic existence is just a loser in their personal lives, and they have nothing else going on in their lives, and that's why they're into right-wing politics, nationalism. But it's a cope. It's a cope, or it's just the fact some conservatives haven't moved with the times, and as I said before, haven't been hit in the face with the reality of diversity quite yet, you know, but they'll all jump on board eventually. We won't have to deal with the current threshold of conservatism in the future. We're still dealing with it now, but I believe that this brand of conservatism, it'll run its course. Its lifespan is limited, and it's nearing the end of that lifespan.
Yeah, but that actually plays into another aspect of this, though, which is, conservatives always wanted to boil the political down to the personal. And this is why it's a completely wrong-headed attitude. You know, it's the same where I've seen debates where young people will say feminism is, you know, making it difficult to find a good wife and build a family. And then conservatives will say, oh, well, you just need to like go to the gym and, you know, start like get better styling and work on your pickup game or something, and you can find a girl or work harder, get into a better social position, you'll be more attractive, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, look,
yeah, but maybe that's really the end game for life, though. Is the end game for life just getting a girl? Napoleon Bonaparte said, Napoleon Bonaparte, as I said, he said, love is the occupation of idle men, right? So if all you're going to worry about is, like, I think it's going to the gym and looking after yourself is great. That's what I structure my business around, my personal business. It's the kind of work I do. But it's not the be-all and end-all of life, and it's not like everything is downstream from that. I mean, a lot of the time you're faced with such severe circumstances that it's difficult to find the time to take care of your own health because you're too busy competing with Indians to get a job, a low-paying job where you've got to work excessive hours just to make ends meet. And for the ordinary Australian, that's a reality they have to deal with. Maybe if you're a conservative in some remnants of the middle class and you went to a private school and you've inherited some money from mummy and daddy, you might not have been aware of that situation, but most Australians live in that reality. So that's why the whole argument of what we've just been through, you just like not having your life together and you're not going to the gym enough and you don't have a good enough girlfriend or any girlfriend yet. And that's the reason why you're upset about society. That doesn't really hold true to me. It doesn't have a lot of validity.
Yeah, but also like what I was saying there, and this also applies to career, is that, okay, well, let's say someone takes your advice and they're actually competent and they get the girl and they end up working really hard and they're very smart and industrious and they make money and they succeed on an individual level. Okay, well, the social problems that we were talking about mass immigration and feminism and DEI and everything, they still exist. So that individual might be able to succeed, but society at large is still going to be fucked. Like the average person is going to not have as many kids, is the average white guy is not going to be as successful in life because of all of these barriers to his success. And we're talking about politics here. We're not talking about personal fucking development. So you can, if you want personal development advice, you've left politics now. Now you're in the sphere of literally self-help. You're in the sphere of motivational speakers and all this kind of shit. You're no longer talking about politics. Politics is about what is happening in the collective, what is happening on the social level, what is happening on the political level. And so telling me, like, it doesn't matter how much personal success I have, I will care the exact same about these issues because I care about my fucking country. If, you know, white people in my country aren't forming families, they aren't able to own their own homes, they aren't having children, they aren't able to get ahead, and they're basically being crowded out by mass immigration and they're being fucked over by a system that fucking hates them and is trying to genocide them, that's bad. Even if I personally have a nice house in a nice suburb with a hot wife and my 3.2 children or whatever. So,
hang on, you know, so if you started up some phone app and it took off and you joined the elitist tech community within the week, you started making billions of dollars, like, you would still be an ethno-nationalist and you would still be an activist in that scene. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, because the future of our people is at stake. And, like, if the country gets trashed, well, even if I personally or my children or whatever go to a nice school and we're doing okay, on a long enough timeline, it's going to catch up with us. On a long enough timeline, my bloodline is going to go down with the ship with everybody else. So, like, it's just fundamentally short-sighted, even just from, like, a personal self-interest perspective, if you care about your progeny. But then also on the macro level, I care about my country in and of itself. I care about my race in and of itself. Like, we are the race that has created the greatest civilization in history. Many of the great civilizations in history we have created. We have our own culture, our own way of life that produces its own forms of art, its own forms of spirituality and so on. And all of that is going to get wiped away by this process. Well, I'm not going to stand by and let that happen. That's so much bigger and larger and more important than my personal success or failure. That's, like, existential for the entire, like, race and culture that I'm a part of. So preserving that is kind of key. Like, without that, it's all over, basically. It all becomes meaningless.
Do you think that's normal for the average person, though, to put their ethnic collective before their own personal interests? I don't think it's normal. Well, I mean, most people would see their own.
How many men went and fought in the wars to defend our nations and died?
Yeah, but a lot of the reason they fought is for, you know, valor, honor, reward, prestige. They thought they were going to be recognized.
They didn't fight for their country. You tell me they weren't fighting for patriotism for their country? Of course they were.
To some degree, but, like, they were also fighting for glory, honor. They were promised things that probably they never got. They had a different idea about what war was.
They were fighting for glory and honor, and, I mean, those things are important, but they knew they were fighting for their country, because if you win a war, your country is much better off than if you lose it. You can't get stood over by other countries. Otherwise your country gets ruined. They just take your stuff.
I think there was a healthy balance of, like, individualist motivation and collectivist motivation being patriotism and then the glory and the medals and the ranks. But what's happened now is, everything has come down to individual motivation. It's like there's no collective interest anymore. You're just expected to do things for your own advantage and don't worry about the broader ethnic collective. That's the problem that we're faced with now, right? Like, we need to be a bit more collectivist. We need to get to that 50-50 split again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. But it's all I like being around white people on a selfish level. White people produce the culture I want to live in. You know, I want to walk down the street and be surrounded by whites. I like going out.
But everyone does. Every white person does. When you look at where white people move to, they all choose to live around other white people. So even though they might not admit it openly.
I like white food. I like white socializing. I like being around.
Hang on, Joel. What is white food? Explain to the audience. What's white food?
Well, European cuisine.
Which is what? What is that?
Like, basically everything when you go to a restaurant that isn't, like, some weird non-white ethnic restaurant.
Maybe it's good quality beef cooked medium rare to rare, maybe, like, vegetables, potatoes, and maybe something sweet to spike insulin at the end and help with digestion, right? Would you say that's an accurate depiction of European cuisine?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, even going back to the steppe, like, we were always a people, we were defined as a people that were, you know, we ate meat. You know, we engage in animal husbandry. We took our food around with us because we were mobile.
Yeah, but the meat and three veg meal that is disregarded as some sort of like banal plain thing these days without any sort of culture, that is the most logical, nutritious meal that you can possibly eat. It's all bodybuilders will eat, right? Over and over again. It's the most nourishing for the body. And that is our food. That is our cultural cuisine. I couldn't
give a fuck about the vegetables, but yeah.
Oh, come on. You got to eat veggies. I eat veggies. Well, look, not everyone's into veggies. I've heard that for A-positive blood types, you might want to look this up, guys, too, if you get some time. Eat right for your type. It's a theory that certain blood types respond a little bit better and digest certain foods better. And I find it to be generally true, and I even recommend it to some of my clients when I structure diet plans. So yeah, eat right for your type. You can Google that. If you know your blood type, it'll recommend certain foods that are better for your blood type theoretically. Give it a go.
I just listen to my body. Like I like the taste of many vegetables, but I don't crave vegetables. I don't ever like fantasize about vegetables. What I fantasize about is meat and like fruit and anything milk, creamy, cheese, that kind of thing.
Pineapple, that's man. That's what I ideate. I love pineapple. Yeah, for me, it's like pineapple, kiwi fruits, and any sort of meat. But yeah, I was always the healthiest when I just ate meat and fruit personally and left out all the processed carbs. But anyway, we kind of segued a little bit there. What were you talking about? Sorry.
I was talking about how, like, even from a selfish standpoint, I'd like to keep having my own country because that produces, like, the safest you can be is surrounded by your own people. The best off you can be is being in a country where your people run the country, right? And that's the best possible setup you can have is your own country. Obviously, living in a country that you don't run, that's run by other people with other interests, is always going to be worse. And if you like your own culture, like unless you take a liking to another culture more than your own, like say you just like get obsessed with like the Japanese or something and you want Japanese wife and you want to watch anime and eat sushi and like jack off to weird shit, you know, move to Japan then. But that's not me. I like my own culture. I think most people like their own culture. So in that case, I want to live in my own fucking country. You know, it's not that crazy.
Do you think the Industrial Revolution kind of nuked our culture a little bit? I think after the Industrial Revolution, everything just became about profit. Everything just became about money and doing what was practically necessary to make as much money as possible. Everyone's worth was measured by their wealth. Your identity became your job. Like people wouldn't ask like, where are you from? What tribe are you from? Whatever, something like that. It was always like, what do you do? That's who you are. What you do is who you are. What factory you work at, that's who you are. It's almost like after that revolution, after everything was industrialized, we lost the spirit of who we were a little bit. What do you think?
I mean, it definitely disconnected us from the land. And, you know, there was a lot more organic lifestyle in like an agrarian society where everyone is kind of rooted to a particular soil and then a community forms there that just basically everyone was born there. Everyone dies there more or less over many generations. And so you get a very kind of rich like regional and like local communal culture that springs up around that. And whereas like everything has become a lot more transient, people are moving around a lot. We live in these big mega cities full of millions of people where you don't even know your neighbors. And so obviously things do break down to an extent, but we still have a culture. Like, you know, we've used technology to create more culture. Like think about, I don't know, like rock music or metal music. Like that wouldn't be possible without the Industrial Revolution. There was just simply not you couldn't have an electric guitar. You couldn't have recording equipment, et cetera. There's all kinds of things that we've developed, you know, in the more modern world that defines our culture as well. But yeah, what you're saying is true about people becoming like, you know, they've become too economized in how they see themselves and how they prioritize their life.
It's made us a little atomized and a little cold, and we only really come together for the purposes of business. That's the only real legal reason you're supposed to come together anyway. Business or some fruitless religious exercise that doesn't really benefit the race in any meaningful way. So I think we need to accept and understand that and realize that we've left our roots behind. As a result of that industrialization and that revolution, I think we left our roots behind a little bit and we need to rediscover them. We need to understand the importance of our ethnic heritage.
Yeah, but it's not like these things are about. It doesn't make it impossible though. Like, I mean, the Industrial Revolution happened a long time before you know, Nazi Germany came into existence, right? And they obviously took very seriously who they were as a people. So it's not like it's impossible now, you know, it's over or something.
It's almost like the world rose up against them for doing so, though, right? So they're only a blip on the screen from on the timeline.
Yeah, okay, but also, like, at the time, like, we were all racist as fuck. Like, this is the time when Australia was, like, white nationalist.
True.
We didn't rise up against them because they were racist or something. You know, it was we don't have to relitigate World War II. We've done many streams relitigating World War II. But
what was the main propaganda message used for motivating people to fight Germans for the Second World War? If it wasn't racism, well,
in Britain,
what was
they were like, they were saying that the Germans are going to attack us. The Germans are being aggressive. Like, we've got to stop them from taking over.
So they were accusing the Germans of what they were doing or wanted to do.
Yeah, exactly. And then in Australia, it was like, we've got to help. We're part of the British Empire, right, you know. And, right. then obviously we became focused on Japan as soon as that became more of a threat.
And then Pearl Harbor happened, and that was the excuse to get America in. You know, we're just fighting back. War
because they feel threatened. They don't go to war because they think that the other side has like bad ideas or something. That's like a very bizarre concept that, you know, that's like the retrojected justification for World War II, and then America has reused it like since to fight dumb wars like in Vietnam or in Iraq that became massively unpopular because they weren't threatening us, and we're like, why are we dying so that they can be liberal instead of communist in Vietnam? Or why are we sending our boys to die over which fucking dictator rules Iraq? Like, this is retarded. But that was, you know, obviously there was ulterior motives. Iraq was about, was a manipulation by Israel to serve Israel's geopolitical interests. And the Vietnam War, obviously.
Speaking of,
was at a power struggle over, you know, East Asian geopolitics, but, you know, nevertheless, the point remains that that's very bizarre. Like, in world history, every war has always been justified by, like, imminent threat.
Or at least the perception of a threat, right? But speaking of Israel, yeah. Did you want to comment on the ceasefire between Israel and, God, whatever Hamas is? That seems to have taken place now, right before Trump is about to come into office. I don't know if that's a coincidence. You got any thoughts on that?
I don't think it's a coincidence, but also the ceasefire isn't confirmed yet. Like, it's been negotiated and apparently agreed upon, but it hasn't been finalized. So we'll
it seems see strange behavior that. For the Jews. It seems strange behavior for the Jews. It seems they wouldn't agree to a ceasefire unless they felt they were at a significant disadvantage in the moment, or if it was going to be advantageous to them later.
Well, here's the thing. They've been fighting for over a year now. It started, like 14 months. And they've already achieved a lot of objectives. They slapped Hezbollah back when it flared up with Hezbollah in the north in Lebanon. They successfully backed a rebel overthrow of the Syrian government. And so that's neutralized, you know, the so-called axis of resistance that connected Iran to Hezbollah through Syria to threaten Israel. So they've neutralized that to a very large extent. And in Gaza, I mean, they've bombed the absolute fuck out of Gaza. They've killed so many people. But at the end of the day, the people there are still fighting. All the countries around Gaza, like the other Muslim countries, are all refusing to take them as refugees because, I guess, number one, they don't want them because it will cause social problems in their country. But also, number two, that would just be facilitating Israel's victory by enabling them to, like, just, like, move them out and then take the territory. And so they'd be seen as complicit with Israel, which would be politically disastrous to their domestic populations that hate Israel, because obviously they've got like Islamic domestic populations that aren't exactly, you know, philo-Semitic. Even if a lot of these leadership groups have been bought off by the Americans and Israel to some extent, and, you know, are not directly hostile, their populations are hostile, so that they are politically limited in what they can do. So Israel's in a situation where it basically has two options. Option A is literally just go in and fucking kill everyone, completely everyone, and just literally just like massacre the whole place, which is like millions of people. And it would be like a historical atrocity on like an insane scale. And then the whole world would see them do it. And then they wouldn't be able to say it wasn't a genocide. Like, now, like, lefties say it's a genocide, and then they're able to like argue back, like, no, it's a war, it's not a genocide. And, you know, But if they went in and just literally genocided them, you know, then it would completely destroy their international reputation. The Israeli far right, that's what they want to do. They literally just want to go in and genocide them. They go, fuck it, we can just do it. Like, but the Israeli left are aware that would be really bad optics. It'd be nuclear optics for Israel. And the Jews in America also realize this, you know, because they're trying to sell this to Americans. And it's getting harder and harder to sell it. So, and then, you know, I heard Biden's remarks. Biden's remarks suggest that, you know, he was like, oh, you know, we can't have civilians. I saw an interview of him a day or two ago. And he was like, I said to Netanyahu, you know, we've got your back, but, you know, you can't just be indiscriminately like bombing civilians. And Netanyahu came back at me with, well, you carpet bombed Berlin in World War II. And you dropped nukes on Japan, so you can't tell us what to do. But Biden you know, but it's, which is kind of funny, but, you know, it shows that like the US State Department, even though they are pro-Israel, a lot of them are lefties. Like a lot of them have a left-wing, so like, you know, they still have like a certain amount of moral injunction against genocide.
When Netanyahu said that to Biden, Biden should have said, we only did it because you Jews told us to, you know.
Yeah. And then the thing is with Trump coming in, Trump supports Israel, obviously, but Trump is, he personally hates Netanyahu because he perceives Netanyahu as slighting him and betraying him in the past. When the election was stolen in 2020, he felt like Netanyahu betrayed him after he'd done a lot for him. And, you know, he's made that those feelings known multiple times. So that means that Trump isn't exactly interested in doing whatever Netanyahu wants. He's obviously beholden to Jews, to Zionists, and defending Israel. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean doing whatever Netanyahu wants. So, you know, Israel, therefore, the idea that they could just waltz in and just genocide all of Gaza and the Trump administration would just let them without pushing back at all, you know, I don't know if they necessarily would, because it would be such a bad look for everyone involved. So they're in a position where it's like, well, they've taken some W's. They've really inflicted a lot of damage on their opposition on all sides. So, and you know, the thing is, Israel doesn't have a very big military. The IDF, it is like, they don't have a very big population. They've been taking casualties, you know, like it's not like Israel has the ability to just endlessly wage war, and their own population, it's kind of tired. You know, a lot of people in Israeli society just want the war to end and things to go back to normal. So people have been displaced from their homes who live like, you know, close to the border and things like that. So there's a lot of political pressure to end the war is my point. So, you know, that's what people need to realize when it comes to Israel. It's like, yeah, Jews have a lot of power, but it doesn't mean like it's still power that's contextualized with a lot of like political concerns. So the logical thing for Israel to do now is to just take the limited W that they received and walk.
Realistically, though, as long as there's still Palestinian people, a Palestine on the world map and Palestinian territory, the war will continue. And again, said by Napoleon, there's no avoiding war. It can only be postponed to the advantage of one side. I suppose maybe that's what's happening with this so-called ceasefire, a postponement of that war to the advantage of one side.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously fighting between Israel and Hamas has flared up, and the Palestinians in general has flared up many times over the years. So this is kind of following the same pattern. Flares up, they fight for a while, and then eventually both sides grow weary, and then they cut some deal, and then one side violates the deal, and you know, it flares up again and it just goes back and forth. So it's a mess. But I think what this should be a lesson to us is that, you know, it isn't worth hyper-fixating on. There's some people in the movement that I think over-fixate on Israel and Palestine. We should be critical of Israel, but it isn't the be-all and end-all of everything. You know, a much bigger deal is what Jews are doing in our societies, in our countries to genocide us. As opposed to the so-called genocide of the Palestinians or whatever. I don't think a lot of people have realized that through this whole process. People got a little bit over fixated upon it originally. And you know, talk of like, we need to make an alliance with the Muslims against the Jews and all this kind of bullshit. And those people look pretty silly now because, you know, the Muslims clearly aren't our friends. You know, there was the riot, particularly like events in Britain. You know, the events in Britain really make it clear that Muslims, you know, can't really be our allies. Not that I'm against Palestine. I just don't. I'm also just not going to expend any energy in the defense of Palestine. They're not doing anything for me. And it doesn't actually matter. Like, the support of Nazis isn't going to materially help the Palestinians in any kind of serious way in their struggle against Israel. They don't even want our support. Like, if you try go to a pro-Palestine rally as like a Nazi, and they...
What about what they say to you in response to that? Well, don't expect any sympathy for us when the right... the white race is on the verge of extinction in the future.
Yeah, we're not getting any sympathy. So why would I expect it to magically start emerging? They're actively part of the process. They're actively working toward our genocide. You know, the Islamic population is one of the more hostile immigrant groups in the West. Like, the crimes they're committed against our people are just unspeakable. So
yeah. Yeah, and friendliness, friendship with them, as you've mentioned in previous streams, is always, it can only continue so long as you're like supporting their agenda. As soon as you put your own agenda on the table or you have your own standards, well, they're going to take issue with that, especially if you're demonstrating your own ethnic rights or interests. But we've been streaming for just over an hour now, guys, and we got good viewership. Thanks for joining us again. It's been a good show so far. And what's the next talking point, Mr. Davis?
Yeah, well, I want to go back to the talking about conservatism and conservative attitudes, because there was something that we were talking about before on the phone before the show. And I was talking about how being a good person, like the principles that make you a good person on like an interpersonal basis, are actually not good principles in politics, and vice versa. Principles that make you like a bad, defective person.
I like this. Listen to this, guys. This will be interesting because this was a good discussion point. It's interesting.
Yeah, and this relates to conservatives, because conservatives will say, hey, look at the left. Look how pathological they are. They blame all of their problems on society. They don't take responsibility for their own lives. Look how unreasonable they are. Look how full of hate and how vitriolic they are and how they're obsessed with politics because they don't have anything important going on in their own lives, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these criticisms are all true, but the left is winning, right? Because what the left wing feel is that the problems in their lives, they project them all onto us, onto their enemy, and they attack. They use every aspect of vitriol in the book. They have no gentlemanly fairness. They don't try to reason with us. And it's a very effective political force as a result, because they are fighting an existential cutthroat battle. And conservatives are just like, oh, come on, man. Why don't you chill out? Leave us alone. And like, not taking it seriously. Because conservatives, as I said before, they always try to reduce the political to the personal. And it's like, and the conservatives think that, like, oh, well, if I go to the average normal person and I go, look at these wokes, aren't they unhinged? Aren't they out of touch? And the average person is like, yeah. It's like, all right, now the normal person is on my side as a conservative. Well, I don't want them to like me. So I'm just going to act chill. I don't want to be too radical. I don't want to be too extreme. I don't want to be too vitriolic, because that's going to make them like me. And it's like, okay, so normal people like you, and maybe they vote for the conservative party in the election. Conservatives usually win more elections than they lose. But what does that fucking count for? Is that person going to be politically active in any way, shape, or form? No. So what you're doing is you're appealing to people that want politics to leave them alone, that don't want to deal with politics, that want to be free of politics, and you're going up against people who are obsessed with politics. So which side is going to win? Obviously, the side obsessed with politics and making everything political is going to steamroll over you every time, because you're engaged in a political struggle. So what I think people need to get through their heads is that you need to have a completely different frame of reference for dealing with politics relative to dealing with your personal life. Like, when you look at, like, let's say that the conservatives are right. Let's say that, like, you know, young white Zoomers these days, they have a bad attitude. They don't want to work hard enough. The reason why they can't get a girlfriend is because they're jacking off to anime and they're, you know, they have a bad attitude and blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's just say we grant all of those talking points as true. Now, like, so what? Like, is that actually going to help you win politically by just critiquing, you know, the kind of frustrations that align with your side of politics and then just sitting on your hands and doing nothing to solve those problems? No, what's going to help you win at politics is weaponizing all of their frustrations, taking their alienation and pointing it and directing it as a weapon against the enemy. And, you know, that's the kind of essential problem with conservatives. It's like in the political arena, you know, we're not here to work out whether everyone on our side has everything altogether perfect, because the thing is, it's a group of human beings. Everyone has flaws. We're here to work out and adjudicate, are the rules of the system benefiting us, or are they benefiting our opponents? Are they rewarding us? Are they rewarding our opponents? That's all that matters in the sphere of politics. Then when you're sitting, you know, when you're with your friends, your associates, people in your personal life, then you can talk about personal advice. Then you can talk about what, you know, what's a good strategy for getting a girlfriend to the young guys, or you can talk about how to build their career or whatever. And you can have that kind of productive, and you take care of people and you act like a gentleman. But we shouldn't be acting like gentlemen towards our political enemies. They fucking hate us and they want us destroyed. We need to cultivate and teach the right wing how to think politically, how to act politically. And it's, I understand that it's counterintuitive. It's almost like more intuitive to people that have mental illnesses. Like if you're a narcissist or a psychopath or something, you're going to actually more naturally understand how to be successful at politics, because politics is kind of fucking psychopathic because it's a battle over power. But unless people can figure out how to separate the political from the personal and operate in the political domain according to rules that can win, we're going to get beasted on time and time again by our mentally ill friends over on the left that intuitively understand these principles.
Are you saying that we ought to adopt the same sort of strategies leftists would adopt, such as attacking the person rather than the message, hysterical emotional responses, anger? What else would leftists do? Victim culture and like that constant idea that everything that's wrong in their life is a result of the system and some sort of systemic oppression. You're saying that we should adopt those kind of strategies. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously we can acknowledge, I'm saying to divide the, like in the political sphere. So obviously we don't want to become like leftists in the personal sphere because that would make us mentally as effective. But in the political sphere,
you want us to be effective in politics, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You have to like understand the distinction. So in the political sphere, when we're having a debate about policy, there's points that are raised on our side, which is, well, on a systemic level, there's mass immigration that has a negative effect. There's DEI, discrimination against whites. All of these things have unquestionably negative systemic effects on young white men and whites in general. And you could say the same thing about feminism. Unquestionably, it has systemic negative effects on family formation and things like that. Now you could say, okay, well, for you to succeed anyway, here's all my personal advice on how to still get a girlfriend and succeed in business anyway. And it's like, okay, but can we just acknowledge that in the political sphere, these things are happening and they're bad. And if we could change them in the political sphere, it would be good. Because if we can just acknowledge that, now the political conversation is over. We don't even need to go into the personal. Personal life needs to be totally separated from the political, because politics is a space where you are competing over rights and privileges and rewards and punishments and how they get distributed, like on the collective level.
I think it takes a certain certain sort of person to be able to do this, though. You need to be a little nuanced in your character. You can't be too overly steadfast in your principles necessarily. What you're asking people to do there is to be a little unscrupulous, to behave one way in politics and then a different way in their personal lives. Can you accept that not everyone's really capable of doing that?
Well, I think we can teach people, because we can say, well, look, it's like what we were saying before about identity politics, and people say, well, I don't want to be grouped into identity political groupings, and I don't want to be, you know, forced to have to, you know, engage in like racial conflict, and I just want to be left alone to grill. And it's like, okay, well, the thing is, the enemy isn't leaving you alone. So we've got to fight. It's like, oh, I don't really want to, you know, do boxing. because I don't really like boxing. And it's like, okay, well, if that was the case where like we're just sitting around and I was like, hey, you want to have a spar? Well, you can say that. But what happens when someone's coming in and is trying to beat you up? Well, it doesn't matter if you don't like boxing. You better start fucking putting your hands up. You better start throwing punches because you're in a fight. And that's what's happening at the political level. We're in a fight. They are literally stealing our fucking country from us. They are coming after you. They, all of these things that I'm talking about are ways to destroy your ability to have a good life. And they are being done to us by the most powerful people in our society en masse through the political system. And they're making your life worse and worse and worse. And it only gets worse from here. And they're going to make your children's life even worse than your life and your grandchildren's life even worse than theirs if you even have grandchildren, because they're going to try and stop you from even doing that. So it's like, at what point do you just recognize, okay, we're in a fucking fight. And that means we're in a new, it's a new paradigm. Politics isn't about, oh, like what would be a nice idea or ideal circumstances. It's about how do we win this fucking fight? And that's the fundamental disconnect here between what I'm saying and what a lot of these conservatives are saying. They're not acting like they're in a fight because a lot of them are paid off by Jews. They're making good money. They're part of the inside group. And this is the other thing as well. They always accuse people like me of being ideologues and purity spoilers. You know what the left wing is full of? Ideologues and purity spoilers. Left-wing, if you ever listen to like what left-wingers say when they talk amongst themselves about politics, even though they've been winning for fucking decades and getting more and more of everything that they've been fighting for, you know, there were left-wingers that were like totally fringe lunatics in like the 1970s that were promoting transgenderism. And everyone was like, what the fuck? Like, this is crazy. Now they've like won. Now it's like government policy and shit. So they're teaching it to the kids in schools en masse. But left-wingers act like, oh, it's never been this bad. Elon Musk and Trump have risen. The fascists are winning. Oh, man, like this sucks. Like they act like they're losing. They're always dissatisfied with the results of politics. They're always pushing for more. They're always demanding more out of their side of the political aisle. They're always attacking their own side. And they're rigid in their ideology. Meanwhile, on the right wing, we get like a slight right-wing victory. And then someone like me comes along and says, oh, well, actually, this isn't really a proper victory because of this reason and that reason. And they go, well, can't you just take the win? Can't you just learn how to be satisfied with winning? Or you just have a loser mindset. You'll never be satisfied with anything. And can't you see these people are doing their best and they're on our side? We shouldn't be attacking them. And it's like, that's a fucking loser mindset. If you get 10% of what you
mean, what do you mean, Joe? What do you mean? Mark Zuckerberg just removed tampons from the men's bathrooms at Facebook corporate. Aren't you satisfied with that? Come on, man. Just take the win.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's like until we have to develop, that radical purity spiraling dissatisfaction where we go, no, actually we demand loyalty. We have an ideology with principles and we demand that we get what we want out of our political team. The right wing is supposed to be our political team. And if they're not going to give us what we want, we're going to fucking be pissed off and we're going to attack them. And it's actually way more productive to attack the right wing politicians than to attack the left wing politicians, because the left wing politicians aren't on our fucking side anyway. They're not even pretending that they're trying to appeal to us. The right wing politicians at least pretend that they're on our side, you know? So that means that they have to at least keep up appearances. They're participating in some kind of discourse under the pretext that we're apparently fighting the same enemy. And so that means there's so much more legitimacy when we attack them. Like it's actually relevant. And what's been great about like recent developments in online discourse is that the right wing is so much more focused upon attacking our own side than attacking the left, because every man and their dog agrees that the left suck, right? It doesn't mean shit. What actually means something is when you say, I'm not just trying to, you know, get Trump elected or get the left wing out of government. We've got to get Albanese out of government. This government's been terrible. What? So you can put Dutton in and you get the exact same fucking policies with like a slightly different media spin. Big fucking deal. It's going to be the same shit, more or less.
I understand. I do understand what you're saying, but a clip Jacob put out recently, Jacob Hursant, I've got it right here actually on my Telegram. The caption to the clip was, "In propaganda, never appear as the old against the young, nor as the humorless against the funny." I understand what you're saying, but I'd like to slot in there that we need to retain, we don't want to become the crybabies, that nothing's ever good enough and we can't have fun and we lose our youthful vigor, our spark, and our ability to be creative and funny. We still need to retain all of that and have a little bit of fun with our politics in addition to never being satisfied. You know what I mean? So I'd like to not become like the modern left, basically, is what I'm saying. Inability to make real jokes. Yeah.
I think we do that, though. Like, I mean, the online right, I mean, it's constant ridicule and memes and I think we have that youthful spirit. And also, this whole discussion, I'm defending the concerns of young people against old people, basically. Like, old boomer conservatives, that they're the ones that are promoting the bootstrapsism, the get a job. And I'm saying, no, how about we actually sympathize with the concerns of young people? Because young people have been, they aren't being given the same deal that you got. We're getting
In defense of boomers, I've noticed there's some boomers out there these days that are starting to really jump on board. Like, I'm seeing, you know, boomers that were formerly associated with just like bland patriotism or maybe the freedom movement around the COVID lockdown type stuff. These people are actually becoming ethno-nationalists. It's really cool to see them jump on board. So, yeah, not all boomers are into that conservative stuff, but it does tend to be a, you know,
boomer not mindset. All. It's not all, like, but that's like a generational attitude, you know. So when we talk about, I'm not saying every single boomer needs to be executed, they're completely irredeemable. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that there's a general kind of generational distinction in attitudes. And obviously if they're white nationalists and they're watching our show, they're not your average boomer, right? They're not, or Gen Xer, because a lot of people are Gen X, but we just call them boomers anyway because it's that attitude.
I know that most older generation people have certain, you know, ideological problems, present themselves as problems to us a lot of the time. But I was just trying to throw some love and support out there to our Nazi grandmas. We have the best grandmas, and, you know, your support is very much appreciated.
Yeah, no, we definitely, we got Mum Waffen, we got Grandma Waffen. No, we do get support from all generations, but primarily the movement needs to anchor itself in the youth, and older people would surely understand this. It's for a few reasons. Number one, young people have more neuroplasticity than older people, so they're more open to worldview changes and new ideas on average. Number two, young people have more energy, more vigor. And so, you know, when you're trying to engage in political activism, that you need to like use that youthful energy. They're the ones that are going to push things in a new direction. Number three, if you convert a young person to white nationalism, well, then you've got potentially 50, 60 years of white nationalism to get out of them. Now, you could say old people, you want to get some because old people have more resources. And so they've got a lot to contribute on that front. And that's definitely true. So you don't want to completely like just be like, fuck old people or something. But you want to be like youth focused, you know, when you're a radical movement. And every radical movement, every revolutionary movement in history has been, you know, fighting age males, basically, as its core. And I don't anticipate that ever changing. And number three, young white men are the ones that have the maximum amount of alienation from the system. Because older people lived at a time when our countries were less fucked, they were able to get themselves into a social position where they were better able to withstand what is happening now. Whereas young people never got a chance to get established under, you know, a relatively homogenous society that wasn't as institutionally, you know, rigged against us. And so it's, you know, we can't even really get started and get established. And so we got less to lose. And the less you have to lose, the more likely you are to embrace revolutionary politics because you literally don't have anything to lose. So, but anyway, I think in summary, though, I guess I would say that if we're looking at politics in terms of like what strategies to employ, I've said this many times over the years, the left are so much better at getting what they want. We've just seen the left completely dominate our culture and institutions for decades and install their values over the entire system. And we've seen conservatives basically take a back step and then another back step and then another back step on every issue for decades, and lose on every single issue, basically. So it's like when we're trying to look at which side we should emulate tactically, we should definitely be looking to the left, not to the conservatives, because they're the ones that actually win. And we want to win. Where conservatives, they've lost everything in perpetuity for decades. So basically everything that they think is suspect. There isn't one conservative idea that we should accept without brutal scrutiny, because they've clearly got some things wrong. Because if they didn't have things wrong, wouldn't they be winning?
Yeah. Can't argue with that. Can't argue with most of Joel's talking points, which is, I suppose, why it's so hard to get someone to debate Joel Davis. Everyone's intimidated, but surely there's some illustrious leftist academic out there, a Marxist, or even somebody from, you know, the pro-Israel camp that's got the guts to debate this guy. Come on, there's got to be someone out there. Just get in the DMs and we can set it up. It's a good opportunity too. Like, you get to go on stream with Joel Davis and flex your intellectual prowess. You can beat Joel Davis in a debate. Imagine that. Imagine the credibility you'll get amongst your community. Put yourself out there. Have a crack. But how are we going for our time?
I saw Tim Lutz on Twitter saying too that Rukshan Fernando, who he streams with Avi Yemeni sometimes, he's like Sri Lankan or something, and he calls himself a conservative, I think.
Who does Avi Yemeni stream now, does he?
Yeah, I don't think anyone really watches it. He doesn't get anything like our view count, obviously.
Everyone's starting to stream now. We've started it. Have you noticed we've started a trend, Joel? Like, everyone's having a crack at a stream.
Yeah, everyone's copying. But the thing is, you're going to tune into the Avi and Rukshan show? I mean, forget about it. Who's watching that show?
What do you even talk about when you're Avi and Rukshan? Like,
I don't know.
What are some of the talking points? Palestine bad, Australian-Israeli unity. I can't come up with anything funny. I'm trying to come up with something laughable, but there's literally like nothing coming into my head. I suppose
there isn't anything funny on the show either.
I'll have to see it for myself, I guess.
But anyway, he's had a lot to say on Twitter about us, and I engaged with him a few times because he has very badly...
Avi or Rukshan?
Rukshan. He has very badly veiled resentment towards white Australians. I can't interact with Avi on Twitter because he blocked me.
Avi, you're a bad sport. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. I tried to engage Avi in discourse in public before. He wasn't interested. I tried to engage him online. He blocked me. So he doesn't really have the balls to debate me, it seems. But Rukshan actually...
Maybe he's smart enough not to debate you.
Yeah, maybe. But Rukshan has engaged me a few times online. We've had words back and forth. And, you know, it seems like he goes on about how apparently, like, the Dravidians have a superior intellect to us, you know, white Australians. We're just all dumb, retarded.
What is that? What is a Dravidian, Joel? What is that?
The Dravidian is, like, the racial group that is the foundation of, like, Sri Lankans, Indians.
God, isn't that classic Indian arrogance to actually think that?
Yeah,
I suppose that's, like, what's compelling. To actually argue with you is that classic Indian arrogance.
There's more Aryan admixture. There's some Aryan admixture in general, but more in the north of India from the legacy of the Aryan conquest, you know, thousands of years ago. And the Aryans were obviously our boys, but their caste system collapsed and they all got miscegenated with Dravidian to various degrees. So the, you know, you might be able to find the occasional pretty white looking, you know, green eyed, you know, Northern Indian Aryan, but they're few and far between. I actually like worked with a gentleman who was Afghani, but when you looked at him, you would have thought he was like Italian or Spanish or something. He had green eyes and straight hair, relatively fair. And yeah, basically the facial features you'd expect from some kind of like Mediterranean type. And but he had a bit of a, you know, an interesting way of speaking and an interesting aura. And so I said, you know, where are you from? And he said, I'm from Afghanistan. And I was like, Wow. Okay. I thought you were a white, like you look white to me. I guess like, you know, you got a lot of, you're relatively pure Aryan blood from historical migrations. And he was like, yeah, my family, this, that. And anyway, so you do find people in that part of the world, Iran, Northern India, and so on, that almost look white. But they're few and far between. But anyway, I digress. The point is that Rukshan, apparently he's so much smarter than us. I'm an idiot, apparently. And he put a clip of our show up and he had something to say. So, you know, he obviously wants to engage in discourse. So why don't we get a debate organized? Why don't we?
I just tried to bring up Avi's stream. Is it called the Opposition Podcast? It is, isn't it? I think that's what it's called.
I'm sorry.
And it's behind a paywall. You can't even watch it. You got to pay him. Oh, isn't that classic?
It's quite Jewish. Yeah. Don't they have like funding? Like, it's kind of crazy. But yeah, obviously they don't care about getting their message out as much as, yeah, everything's got to be monetized. But anyway, look, if Avi won't debate me, at least send in your little brown minion, Rukshan, to have a crack. Let's debate whether immigration is good for Australia. And we don't just have to talk about it in terms of like the specifically high rates. Because Rukshan, he identifies as a conservative. He probably would acknowledge like something like, oh, the housing crisis is a result of, you know, the immigration running too hot. But obviously he thinks like multiculturalism is good, or at least like multiracialism. Maybe he would say everyone needs to assimilate. Well,
he has to think that. He's Sri Lankan living in Australia, right? He has to think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And obviously he does think that because he was defending it and, you know, critical of our view. So let's have the debate and let's have a chat about it. I think these kinds of discussions are interesting. And then if your ideas are so much better than mine, and my ideas are so stupid, then it should be exposed in the free marketplace of ideas as for the audience. So let's see if he has the ball.
I hope he does. I think that'll be great. I think he could do a better job than Drew Pavlou. Maybe not though. He'll have to demonstrate himself and prove it. But speaking of Tim Lutz too, if this is the real Tim Lutz in the comments, he's asked us to bring up a certain topic.
Well, we should talk about the fact that his house got raided. So his house got raided, I believe, Wednesday morning, early hours in the morning. I think he'd already left for work because, you know, Tim starts early. But his house was raided. You know, his young children were woken up by police barging in to seize whatever, his NSN jacket. And I guess they usually seize electronics. I haven't had a chance to see Tim since it happened to get all the specifics, but they barged in. There's an article up on the Noticer.news. I shared it on Twitter and on Telegram yesterday. So you can read the article if you want to read, some actual official reporting on it. But basically it seems like they came in to do a raid on the basis of apparently that fuck off we're full rally, the second one where we all got pepper sprayed. They're charging him with, they didn't charge him, but they have an intent to charge him, apparently, with grossly offensive public conduct for him being at that rally. It's kind of strange that they didn't, because I was the leader of that rally. I didn't have a mask on. It's kind of strange that they didn't come and charge me about it. And what it feels like to me is that, you know, I'm under investigation for the Jews Hate Freedom rally. Jacob Hursant is under investigation for the Halloween, where he dressed up in the KKK outfit video. Tom Sewell is under investigation for been charged with offensive behavior, not grossly offensive public conduct, which is indictable offense you could do jail time for, but the summary offense, offensive conduct, which I believe you can't do jail time for. For the rally that we did in Ballarat in late 2023 for the anniversary of the Eureka Stockade. So, and he's also got caught for allegedly, they say he intimidated a police officer when he discussed on the stream.
I think you still can do jail for summary offenses, especially if it's like repeat, but you just don't need to be on bail for them. That's the difference.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, that intimidating a police officer is a more serious charge, and he's going to be in court for that. So they've got Tom already in court, and they've got investigations and the probability of laying charges over the head of me and Jacob, and also Nathan Bull and another associate of ours, Will, they also raided their houses over the Halloween thing. So I don't know if they're intending to charge them as well or what. We haven't heard anything from the police yet. They've got, it could take months until they put charges. So there's all these other active investigations ongoing. And they got me, they got Jacob, they got Tom and some of the other boys. But like Tim is, you know, the most prominent leader in the org that hasn't got anything over his head. So it almost felt like they were like, oh, we've got the Jews have gone into the government and they're like, what the fuck's going on? Why, you know, we need these NSN guys in jail. And then like the premier or something has gone to the police commissioner and is like, you know, what are you doing? And he's like, we've got active investigations on him and charges on him. And they're like, but what about Tim Lutz? He's like the leader of the Victorian chapter. Why doesn't he have an investigation? And so they just like went, oh, let's go and like slap something on him. And they just like arbitrarily chose that because I don't know, then maybe they got footage of him after the rally or something. And so they could like, you know,
has he, was Tim at home while this raid took place?
No, he'd already left for work. He'd already left for work in the morning.
So his family was home, but he wasn't, has he been charged? Yeah. Has he actually been seen by police and charged or not at this stage?
I don't think he's been charged. I think he's under investigation with the intent to charge as far as I know. So
there was a comment from him here saying, this is from Tim, Victoria police being investigated for sex crimes and family violence, yet think it's okay to go into my teenage daughter's room while she's sleeping. Yeah, that is a little bit unethical, isn't it? I'd be concerned with that. And I think, isn't the person who's being investigated, aren't they supposed to be at the premises when the raid takes place? I don't know. I suppose it's...
Well, they raided my house when I wasn't home and they went through my shit without me being home as well. So, well, I guess they have to have a warrant. They can just go in and do what they want. To an extent, but
maybe someone needs to be, as long as someone's home, they can come in, I guess. But you would think they would know his working schedule. So, or maybe they don't know it, but yeah, you would think with how much police attention the boys get, they would know that stuff. So it's almost like they waited for him to go before they could raid him. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's pretty wild. But it's just ridiculous. I think like the scenario that I speculated on where they just have like, they're just responding to political pressure. I think something like that scenario is probably what's going on, which just goes to show how much of a joke this whole operation is. You know, it's just clear political policing where they're just trying to like conjure up bullshit pretexts and bullshit cases, that have no precedent, to come at us with, because we don't actually break the law and we're just exercising our rights to engage in, you know, peaceful political protest. So anyway, when he is charged, obviously, or when any of us are charged, obviously we will let everybody know when more comes to light.
It's an interesting precedent, because if you said they just took the clothing that they claimed that he was wearing at a specific protest, I'm sure that clothing might also contains like a mask, right? A face covering. If they don't have any footage of him at the actual event, yet they're taking the clothes from his house as part of a raid investigating some incident at that event, they might try to set a precedent by proving he was at the event and, you know, identifying him just by the clothing that they produced at the court. Maybe that's what they're up to, but well, I'm not sure.
Standard practice. They seized my NSN jacket. They seized all the clothing I was wearing, and they did the same thing to Tom and, to Jacob, even like on Halloween, Nathan Bull dressed up as like a black, you know, cotton picker, like in blackface, and he put like this, you know, Halloween costume on. When they went to his place over that Halloween video that Jacob made, they were trying to seize his, you know, blackface Halloween costume. So this is how ridiculous these people are. But yeah,
did you get your sunglasses back yet, Joel? Or are they still in police custody?
No, I won't get them back until it's this whole, either the investigation is over or if I get charged, the whole court process is over. So it could take a long time.
Have you found a new pair?
Yeah, I just got another pair of the same ones.
Nice work. They look cool. I don't want to, I don't want you to be hamstrung by not having that look, man.
It's, well, you know, it is what it is, but like, it's kind of, it's become distinctive now because there's been a few rallies where I've rocked those glasses. And so they've become iconic. Like that Fuck Off We're Full rally, I had them on. And, you know, there were some iconic photos from that. And then obviously from the Jews Hate Freedom. So it kind of, it fits the aesthetic as well. Like it fits the overall, like the jacket and everything.
I've been a little bit inspired by your mullet. I got my hair cut to get a mullet happening. It's like in the beginning stages, but I'm doing the mullet as well. I've been inspired. It looks cool. I've never had one either. I've never actually had a mullet. I just grew my hair really long once and didn't cut it for like a year. But yeah, this will be my first mullet, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, well, I mean,
do you think the mullet is really the stereotypical Australian haircut? Kind of seems to be.
Well, it is. I mean, you see mullets everywhere. Yeah, if you get the mullet, I'm going to have to shave it off. I'm going to have to move to whatever the next...
Nah, man, we have completely different, like, hair, the way it grows and shit. So
yeah, but I don't know. It's like, it's becoming mainstream. I've got to
say... Yeah, the old contrarian can't go with the flow.
Maybe I'll go back to the mohawk. When I was a teenager, I had like a big like spiked up mohawk, like completely shaved sides.
I believe it too. Joel's had some interesting experiences throughout his life. And actually, someone's got a question. They've actually made a super chat in relation to that. And I'm interested to get your response to it because there's been some wild accusations about you thrown around in relation to this specific topic. Let me know when you're ready to move on to super chats and we can do that. Have you got another subject, Matty, you want to talk about first? Or?
No, we can just do the super chats. I think it makes sense.
In that case, I'll ask you this one because this was the first super chat we got tonight. It was from Stone Mountain, who sent through $20. They're keen to ask this question. Joel, why do you have a Baphomet Illuminati tattoo? Not hating, I just want to know the story. They sent through the money, man, so
well, let's answer this question. It's not an Illuminati tattoo, but I got it when I was a teenager, edgelord, and I was in death metal bands and I was into death metal at the time. And it was like the death metal aesthetic is always is kind of like satanic and like gruesome and so on, dark, edgy. And so I was attracted to that. And I didn't interpret it. Like people interpret the Baphomet or the symbol in a way that has the connotation of like, you know, child rape rituals or something like that. But I didn't interpret it like that. I interpreted it in a different way. But yeah, like it was an edgy, like teenage decision. Obviously, it doesn't represent like my like religion. I don't like have like, I'm not a secret Satanist or something. Because I've got an edgy tattoo. It's just a tattoo. And I probably will. I do intend on getting it covered up with something else. But yeah, I just haven't gotten around to it. I've just had other priorities in my life than being worried about tattoos. Yeah. And you can't see it unless I take my shirt off. And I just generally don't take my shirt off unless I go to the beach or something. The only reason people are talking about it was because a shirtless photo of me got leaked online against my will, you know? Someone violated.
Do you at least look pretty good in it? If you look good in it, say like, fuck it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, the photo, I mean, I look good in it. Like, I think I look good in it. I think...
That's good. Would I be accurate to say, like, because from experience, like, I got a tattoo when I was 18 that I wish I didn't get as well. It's actually the only tattoo I have, which is my sun sign. The scorpion. I did some of it myself too, actually, in a friend's garage, so it was pretty sloppy. But when you get a tattoo that you're not really that thrilled about, you kind of just forget about it. You stop thinking about it, and you a lot of the time just forget it's there. And then when you do see it, you know, it just becomes part of your everyday ritual, seeing it on your body, and you don't really think much about it. But it's more of like a scar from a time where you were less developed and just into some shit that you kind of aren't. It's not that I'm not really into astrology anymore. If anyone knows me, they know that I'm into my astrology. But like, I'm definitely not into tattoos. I would never get a tattoo again. And if I could go back, I wouldn't have got it because it was just like something I didn't think a lot about. So yeah, it's kind of something you forget, and then it's more of a scar marking a time when you were younger and less developed. That's what younger tattoos end up being when you grow up.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I wouldn't mind getting it, like getting something else done over it. I have some ideas. But yeah, it's just like a whole process of getting it designed. I'll get around to it when I do. That's why I haven't, that's why it's still there and there isn't something else. Because people say, oh, why didn't you get rid of it? And I was like, well, I've been meaning to cover it up for a while, but you know, it's just not exactly my top priority. Like I said, if I'm wearing a shirt, you can't see it. And I don't usually go around without a shirt on because I live in a society.
Yeah, the next one is Calmius, who sends $3. Tough times, Calmius. He says, collab with Ozpil when? Ozpil's been producing some good content. He's of the younger generation, I think, and I've seen him on Instagram and TikTok where, well, I haven't seen him on TikTok, but I've heard that he's on TikTok. I'm banned from TikTok, and they also blocked my phone number. So I don't think I can make a new TikTok account from my current device unless maybe I work some VPN magic or something. I don't know how it works. But he gets some good views, and I'm really appreciative of his content. It's good to see someone from the younger generation really getting into their identity, the crisis that we're in this country, and get the information, the facts out there to the kind of the average viewers. So a lot of other people appreciate this guy too. What do you reckon, Joel? You got thoughts on Ozpil?
I think Ozpil does great work and very supportive of what he does. And that's why I promote him. So yeah, he does great work. And he does good. He's on Instagram, he's on TikTok, he's on Twitter. And yeah, just good at putting out anti-immigration, pro-white propaganda.
One of his latest videos too was about the Australia Day event hosted by Matt Trye, National Workers Alliance, next weekend at Rod Laver Arena. I'm hearing it's going to be pretty big. It's a pushback against Jacinta Allen refusing to reinstate the traditional Australia Day parade in Melbourne and claiming that it's not her responsibility. But it kind of is. She probably could do something about it if she wanted to. She's just, you know, not really interested in helping us out. But yeah, that's happening next weekend. It's going to be big. Make sure you tell your friends about it and get down there. There's another note I made here too. Mark Collett from over in England, he recently got a recording of an interview he did with the British Broadcasting Corporation Wales because they're doing a story on him. They had a spy on him secretly recording certain members of his Patriotic Alternative saying things in private conversation. And they also recorded me apparently saying something in private conversation. And they're trying to do some kind of hit piece to try to justify a law to maybe outlaw his group specifically over in England. It's basically just a big left-wing media attack against Collett and Patriotic Alternative. But he's just done an interview with them, which he recorded himself. And he's going live with that 1 p.m. UK time today, which I believe is in a couple of hours. So if you follow Mark, if you want to watch that, I think you can find him through either Telegram or the Patriotic Alternative X account, which recently launched. They've been banned off X or Twitter for quite a while, but I think they've just gotten back onto that platform recently.
Oh, okay.
So that'll be interesting. I might actually tune into that if I'm still awake or check it out tomorrow. I want to see how that interview went.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I'm keen to see the whole documentary, to be honest. I find those kinds of hit piece documentaries entertaining. Calamus said, RIP David Lynch, indeed, favorite works. Do you like any David Lynch movies, Blair? He just died today. He's a very famous director.
What movies did he make?
Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive. He made like a version of Dune back in the 80s, which a lot of people don't like, but I think it's actually not too bad.
So he's like an old school director.
Yeah, but I mean, he's still been making films. Like he made the Twin Peaks TV show, which is quite famous as well. He's such a famous director because he's so well loved because his movies are very strange. He creates this very unique aura in his films where they're very ambiguous and the characters are kind of unsettling. and you know,
his I tried to watch the original Dune. I tried to watch his interpretation of Dune, and it was actually quite far removed from the books. It was weirder than the books. I made note of that. It was much more detailed and weird. And so I didn't watch it all the way through for that reason. But I have to say, I haven't seen any of his other movies, so can't comment.
Yeah, well, he's a great director. I really like the films that I mentioned. And he also made Eraserhead, which is a pretty well-known film. That was like back in like the 70s. There's another film of his called Wild at Heart, which has Nicolas Cage in it. And that's quite a fun film. It's kind of that's got an interesting energy to it. It's hard to really describe what it is. It's kind of like a romance of sorts, but the main character is just like Nicolas Cage being out of control.
I love Nicolas Cage. If Nicolas Cage is in a movie, I'll watch it.
No, Wild at Heart's a good film. I think you will like that film. And it has, it's just David Lynch was just really good at creating interesting films where, you know, you spend a lot of time like thinking about what did that just mean, you know, his whole philosophy is trying to make you use your imagination rather than just like giving you something that's like non-ambiguous. So anyway, it's not for everyone, but I thought he was a great director. He also like he's just a kind of cool individual. Like he had like enigmatic personality. So rest in peace to a real one. The Bearded Indian said, your social media counterattack of Caroline Marcus was brilliant. You did it the same way they do it. Very personal and public. Every Zog smear mercenary should be dealt with mass ridicule. Well, yep, exactly. And that kind of gets to what I was saying before about being an asshole is actually good in politics. It's not good. Like the rules that make you a nice guy in a community setting, in a setting amongst friends, they're completely antithetical to like political logic. So when you're amongst friends, you should be a supreme gentleman. You should be gracious. You should be caring, altruistic, fair, honorable in every possible way. But in politics, you need to be cutthroat. We talked about Tim Lutz, that's on here. Tim also made the point. There's active investigations that have come out apparently within Victoria Police against like a massive like percentage of their staff pertaining to domestic violence, sex crimes, etc. They've got a really deep problem in the force with, you know, just degenerate, horrible behavior. Yet they're expending how much resources coming after us for having a political opinion. And then bring those potential scum into Tim's house while he's not home and his daughters are, you know, asleep. You know, that's brings a whole other level to that. Stone Mountain said the 10 main reasons conservatives are losing. Well, I only see seven here. Maybe there's another one I got to find. But number one is they're rule followers by default. Number two, they try to be amateur referees and toothlessly point out hypocrisy or the law. I've got here number four, maintainers of the current status quo. Number five, seeks respectability.
Wait, where was number three? We went straight from two to four.
I've got to like scroll. The thing is about fucking this. Here we go. Let me scroll up. Okay. I don't actually see number three. He's gone straight from number two to number four.
Stone Mountain forgot his number. But yeah, number four was what?
Number six. Number four is maintainers of current status quo. Number five is seeks respectability. Number six is atrocious detection and selection of friend and enemy. Number seven, cowardly and easily bullied. Number eight, supports their team no matter what, even if it is making objectively bad or harmful decisions. Number nine, always digs in on the wrong issue. Number 10, always misled with red meat and distractions. Well, there's a lot there. Solutions to solve this, anything you would add or change? Well, you've given us a lot there to dissect, to be honest. I've got to go through 10 different... Or I guess
we might be able to get that done in another two streams. So maybe
A month or two. But I mean, a lot of these things you're saying are good points. Let me like pick one of these things. I think what you said here about supporting their party no matter what, even if it is making objectively bad or harmful decisions. That's objectively the case. But the problem is, like, that wouldn't be so bad if they were supporting, like, white people no matter what. They just don't select the team right. They're loyal to the party rather than to the people. And that's what's fundamentally wrong about conservatives and why nationalism is the future. And the main distinction between us and them is I don't give a fuck about any particular party. What I care about is the Australian people and white people in general. And I think that's the fundamental flaw. And that pertains to what you're saying about they don't pick their friends and enemies right because, yeah, like conservatives are good at getting Republicans or, you know, liberal party people elected, but they're terrible at actually achieving anything for our people. Like they always compromise and cuck to the left-wing agenda to get the party in. And then what's the point? The party's only got any value if it's pursuing certain policies and ends that are good for our people. So Stone Mountain also said you should debate Tick history. That guy does the best job I've seen at attempting to debunk ethno-nationalism. He may not have the balls, but I think he'd probably do it though. Well, I would love to debate Tick history. I am familiar with his videos, and obviously I don't agree with a lot of his analysis, but I'm quite happy to debate him because I think... Yeah, his perspective is obviously one that a lot of conservatives listen to, which pertains to what we were saying before, this kind of woke right nonsense. You know, he has this idea that basically people on the radical right, they're not just simply concerned about like securing a future for our race, but we've got this other like strange esoteric like agenda that we're actually pursuing that if you analyze it through Hegelian dialectics, we're actually part of some Gnostic religion and all this bullshit. And it's just convoluted nonsense. So yeah, I would like to deconstruct that in real time. But
one of the boys, while you were explaining that in relation to media spies being in Patriotic Alternative over in England, getting tired. There's a post here on the White Papers Telegram channel. Apparently the last spy, maybe Patriotic Alternative has had spies before, the last media spy actually got bashed by Antifa during a public event. And there's a video of it that I'm watching now. I just thought that was pretty funny that they sent a spy into this particular group and the spy got beat up by that group's political opponents, the same ones that he's kind of like aligned with. But yeah, I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, I actually have seen that video and he's like pleading with them like, no, I'm not actually a Nazi. And then like, they don't care. So it's kind of funny.
You're standing with them. That's good enough for them, mate.
Yeah. Play stupid games, win stupid prizes. Dr. Weeb said, since October 7th, in many corners, any ambivalence towards Palestinians immediately provokes Jew accusations. I don't exactly feel much solidarity with Arabs who have inflicted the worst atrocities upon my race, even if Palestinians themselves haven't. Their co-racialists have. It's been frustrating. Your ultimate loyalty being to abstract civic ideological principles is one of the easiest things to subvert. Easy to lie and claim allegiance to some set of verbal principles. People lie under oath in court all the time. DNA tests are cut and dry. Well, yeah, like this idea that you're Jewish, if you're not pro-Palestinian or you're some kind of Jewish operative, it's like, no, like if you just have a consistent pro-white stance, you're going to obviously be critical towards the Jews and you're going to identify the Jews as like a primary enemy, but that doesn't negate all of our other enemies or concerns. And relativize them to, and we've talked about this on the show many times, a lot of people almost define themselves as counter-Semites first and pro-white second, which doesn't make any sense. Like, why are you against the Jews if it's not in defense of your race? Like, what even would be the point of opposing the Jews at that point? Then are you opposing the Jews because the Jews are supremacist and you think all peoples on earth should be equal and you care about all peoples equally or something and you're just like a liberal? Like universalist or something, then that doesn't really make any sense. Then like why oppose mass immigration?
That works out to the advantage of the Jews in a way.
Yeah, like why oppose mass immigration? Then, you know, why, like a lot of things the Jews are doing, like why even oppose it? Just like embrace what the Jews are doing to us, which is mongrelizing us and like deracinating us because you don't really care about that anyway. So what's the difference? We're all human beings. So, yeah, it doesn't really make... And also, like, it doesn't make sense why the Jews are doing what they're doing unless you look at it through the lens of race, you know, because they're trying to advance their, like, collective ethnic interests. And it's a reflection also of their, like, racial nature, their behavior patterns and predilections. So, anyway, racist aristocrat said... National socialism is, quote, the will to make mankind new, according to Adolf Hitler. That's exoteric. That the esoteric Adolf Hitler... Sorry, the exoteric Adolf Hitler says, I am German. The esoteric Adolf Hitler says, I am Greek. The Aryan is the Prometheus of mankind. The swastika is the hammer of creation. Please, when you send super chats, write it a little bit more legible. He also said, National socialism equals blood and spirit, internationalist, aristocratic, total rejection of Christian slave morality, a race of supermen transcending political or national boundaries. The exoteric being means to an end at a particular stage of development, distinguishing the esoteric NS doctrine of the leadership caste SS from the exoteric NS of average party voter SA resolves the isn't it just for Germany question. Okay, so what he's saying here is that, like, National Socialism on its face just seemed like a form of German nationalism, but esoterically it was about tapping into a deeper understanding of what it means to be Aryan and reviving the aristocratic class and spiritual ethos that had been lost through the damage that was done to Europe. Or European culture and the European race from the fall of Rome onwards. And I think that's true. And he says that means that, like, you know, that shows that National Socialism is of universal relevance to all of our race rather than just to Germans. Drillers said, hey guys, been loving the shows lately. I live on the Gold Coast, but feels like India now. Can't believe the amount of Jeets that have moved here. Shit's fucked. We need to change ASAP. Hail victory. I mean, that's horrible because the Gold Coast is like peak Aryan, you know, like the racial stock up there is really good. There's a lot of babes. There's a lot of chads.
Surfers paradise is kind of shit now compared to the way it used to be. If you get outside surfers, it's not that bad, but yeah, surfers is kind of...
there's a lot of islanders as well. There's a lot of islanders that have moved there. There's a lot of Jeets. There's Asians. Yeah, they've ruined it. It was like one of the greatest places in the world, like, to go on holiday to. If you're a white person, you want to go somewhere that's got epic beaches, epic nightlife, you know, sick theme parks. It was the place to go and party. And, you know, everything's getting ruined. The Gump said, your pure and uncompromised message sets the tone for the coming worldwide white power. One can notice on Twitter how conservatives are and disguised infiltrators are fruitlessly trying to steer Joel towards, and as long as they pay taxes, destructional viewpoint, watch out for these people. Well, I don't think they're going to be able to steer me away. pretty resolute. Deer in the Headlights said, excellent stream, lads. A big welcome to the newest little soul. Glad to hear that mom and baby are doing well. Happy news is always appreciated. Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, Tom obviously said on the show last week he just had another baby. So obviously great news. And everyone's healthy and good as far as I know. A high energy nationalist. He actually sent this after the show last week, but it was like after the show. He said, great show, gentlemen. True nationalists. If we didn't have this broadcast each week, Australia would be far more fake and gay. When are you boys getting a studio with flashing lights, like slightly offensive? Soon. We're definitely aiming to get to develop that soon. But not yet. More on that shortly. But yeah, we're working on things. We've got some gear already, but it's just a bit of a slow process. The Gump said as well, blood and honor. So obviously... blood and honor to you too, sir. Also, racist aristocrat said, my three posts were read backwards, would sound much more coherent in proper order. Yeah, they kind of popped in, I guess, backwards. I didn't, you know, sorry about that. I didn't realize they were all from you until I already started reading them. But I think I got your point.
Didn't mean to throw you under the bus there, mate, and suggest that you're not a racist aristocrat. You're still of the intelligentsia.
Calmius said, have you thought about streaming 2 times a week? Yeah, I mean, sometimes I do. Sometimes I do second streams, but if I did a second stream through the week, I would probably do it on a different topic. Herson and I have been cooking up an idea for a show, podcast type thing, and also I've been talking to other friends like Jack Brady and others about doing collaborations. So I want to add more shows, but just doing this show 2 times a week, I don't think is necessary. I think this show being weekly is pretty good, unless like there was like some special event we wanted to cover. But I don't know. I think I think it's good how it is. It'd be more interesting to add different shows, and like if Blair wanted to do more stuff, the same thing. Like, you know, Blair's been making short form videos. I think they've been really good. It's like you don't want to just do this stream all the time and nothing else. I feel like we want to.
It takes a bit of energy out of me. Streaming takes some energy out of me, and those short form videos I make, even though they're short and sweet, they can take 6 to 8 hours to actually finalize. Like, they take quite a bit of time to put out there, and I do need to save some of my energy to make some good quality content in that regard. So streaming once a week is enough for me.
Yeah. And also Origami said Joel is basically the Nick of Australia. Joel is Australia first, like Nick is America first. Joel is aligning with the Aussie constitution. You're going to get hated, but you're coming around to people. I don't really know what you mean by aligning with the constitution.
What aspect of the constitution specifically? Because that we don't have like, I mean, the Australian constitution isn't something that a lot of Australians even really know about. We don't have that culture down here like they have in America where people know their constitutional rights. Australians don't really know their constitutional rights. That document is obscure. Well, there you go. Australians are a totally different system to America. Like, we don't have the right to bear arms, to defend ourselves, the right to free speech. None of this technically exists. It can all be argued in court. And most people who own guns in Australia do so under pretty strict limitations. Like, you have to keep the guns in a safe, which is bolted to the floor. The ammunition needs to be kept in a separate compartment within that safe or in a different safe. The guns can never be loaded and they can never be easily accessible. The whole point is if someone breaks into your house, you're probably not going to be able to get to the guns in time to use them for self-defense anyway. They're generally supposed to be used only for recreational purposes. You can get pistols in Australia, but you need to be part of a shooting club and you need to attend that shooting club, I think, at least 10 times per year. And you need to register your attendance in order to justify your need to have a pistol. And you still need to store it in the safe, which is bolted to the floor. The ammunition needs to be separate, blah, blah, blah. So Australia is a very different country to America in that regard.
Yeah. Obviously, there's things in the Constitution that we can use, but yeah, it's not like in America where it provides an explicit Bill of Rights. That was okay for a long time when you had a homogenous society. You didn't need a Bill of Rights because the government didn't attack your rights, but our rights were enshrined in law. But then that enables the legislature to legislate them away without any constitutional protections. So, it's just another example of how like liberal democracy is incompatible with multiculturalism. When social trust breaks down, government tyranny, it doesn't have any like obstructions. But anyway, that's going to end the stream for tonight. I hope everyone enjoyed the show. Covered some good ground, and I think we'll end it there. We've been on for like 2 hours. So
thanks for joining us, everyone. I've noticed some people are clipping the show already too. I'm noticing great work with that. There's been some great clips going around lately. Whether or not they're coming from this show, but I've noticed some really good content going around involving particularly Joel and Tom. They've been pumping some great content out there. And the people clipping the content specifically are playing a significant role in getting that stuff out. So if that's your style and if that's what you get up to, It's much appreciated. It's good stuff. Thanks very much. And thanks for tuning in. I love you all, as you know. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next week.
And if you do clip, I really do appreciate the clippers, and post it on Twitter. That's great. But post the clips on TikTok. Post the clips on, they got this Red Note app now people are jumping to because they're talking about banning TikTok in America. It's like another version of TikTok. I haven't gone on there yet and played around with it, but it seems like a TikTok 2.0. Chuck it up on there. Chuck it on Instagram. Chuck our content up on these kinds of platforms and get the message out to people that otherwise wouldn't see it. But, yeah, anyway, thanks for watching. We'll see you all next time. And white power.